Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:03 and that's Pacific Summer Time. And today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And if we have a review of what's been happening this week, then you know, we had a pretty strong start, but towards the end of the week, then that's been fading. And you know, it's against the background of what is an overbought condition on the vast majority of stock markets, where you have a large number of stocks that are either testing big round numbers or are also, you know, at previous peaks. And then when you look at, you know, we're in the middle of earnings season, and today what we saw was really an example of the return of single stock volatility. And that isn't something that we've really had to contend with to any great extent since the third quarter of last year. So, and I've posted a number of charts in Comment of the Day today just to give some examples. But if you look at Google, Netflix, Kimberly-Clark, and Microsoft, then they pulled back very sharply today. And as we approach the close, then the S&P is pretty much unchanged on the day. Well, then you have to ask yourself, well, why is that? So, and it's, again, it's very similar to what we had in the third quarter of last year. And it is because we're starting to get a rotation out of some of the high-flying technology stocks and consumer discretionary stocks and into resources and energy. So the transportation index has now pushed back above its 200-day moving average, and that's loaded with railroads and airlines in particular. But it's primarily the railroads that are driving this outperformance. So Norfolk Southern was one of the better performers today. And when you look at the winners and losers on the day, it was mostly technology shares were down, and it was resources shares were up. Now, that gives us something really to talk about that's very relevant to the big picture and the long term. So perhaps we should frame the conversation today based on what we're actually starting to see now. It's looking increasingly likely that the low is in for the commodity complex. And then we've had a very impressive rally. Then when you get an impressive rally, you get an overbought condition. That's certainly evident, and it's particularly evident in gold shares, where the Gold Bugs Index has rallied 100% this year already, and going from 100 to 200. And of course, that's from very depressed levels. So, you know, when the index was, you know, multiples of where it is today, then 100% rally is a very big ask. But from depressed levels, it's easier to achieve. Well, those then the short term is that because of that short term overbought condition, there's a strong likelihood that we're going to get at least a period of consolidation and even potentially a reversion back towards the mean. And part of the reason for that is because in the first quarter, the dollar was quite weak right across the board, regardless of what basket you want to put the dollar and compare it against, whether that's emerging market currencies or commodity currencies or the G7 currencies. Well, it was weak against just about all of them. And that changed a little bit in here today, where the yen in particular pulled back really very sharply. The yen weakened by over 2 full yen today, and that's a very clear upper dynamic for the dollar, and that's the first one that we've seen in at least 3 or 4 months. So that's at a very minimum, that's near-term dollar dominance, almost certainly short-term, potentially medium-term, and there's potential there for an additional rally by the dollar against the yen, and that should generally be positive for stocks. And the Nikkei today was up about 1.2%. So now it has completely unwound the sharp pullback that we had earlier this week as a result of that earthquake, but it has the potential to go additionally higher from here if the yen continues to weaken. And the BOJ means business. They are at a point now where they're eschewing outright money printing and they're going for negative interest rates. And one of the articles, and I read a few of them today, relating to the news story is hypothesizing that they might even introduce loans with negative interest rates. And that's the very essence of helicopter money. That's where you borrow 100 yen and you only have to pay back 98. And then, you know, that's also an admittance that that there's a deflationary environment overall. So when you tend to think in those terms, there's plenty of scope for the yen to weaken from here, and particularly because the Bank of Japan is probably the only central bank that's really considering these kinds of extraordinary moves in the short term. If you had to say, well, who might be next, it would be the ECB, but of course the message is that the Fed is pretty far away from that. And you know, if they were even to begin to embark on a policy like that, the first thing they would have to do would be to unwind the interest rate hike that they had a few months ago. So there's very little prospect of that. And a chart that I posted yesterday is also worth looking at, and it is the 12-month yield, because it had contracted all the way down from about 70 basis points to 50, and it bounced in here today. So then the contraction in yields, the increasingly short-term bullish environment is all starting to has already priced in an awful lot of good news, and then the question is just how much better is it likely to get. And I suspect potentially not that much better. Now, when we then go back and just address that, this it's an important issue in terms of what we're getting now in the stock market, which is this rotation. The technology sector has been by far the best performing sector over the last 3 or 4 years, and it has exhibited incredible relative strength over the last 6 months, and particularly the very largest companies. Well, Apple's results are going to be, I think it's after the close on Monday. And then we have a number of other big technology companies releasing their earnings next week. And Disney, which was one of the better performers in here today, their earnings are going to be in, I think, 3 weeks' time. So, we're still only about halfway through earnings season, and there are some big ones that are going to be coming down the line. So the potential for single stock volatility to increase is perhaps the base case at this stage. And against that background, then, we're seeing that previously very oversold shares are starting to rally, and not just starting to rally, but have already posted impressive rallies. And the big question now is to what extent that's going to continue. And we have to think about, where are we in the cycle? Well, what we've had over the last 3 or 4 months has been really a lot of demand for shares that offer or that have defensive characteristics, those that have a global reach, that have a that have strong cash flows, and often that have strong records of increasing their dividends. So the dividend aristocrat type companies, the autonomy type companies, then they've done very, very well. Well, against then, they've done so well that what we've seen today is that earnings have not kept up, and that corporate profits have been pretty stagnant and have actually been coming down. And the US corporate profits chart in the library, I think the next update for it comes on April 28th. So we don't have to wait all that long to see what the next iteration on that chart is likely to be. But considering where we are in terms of earnings so far, it's unlikely to be very bullish. Well, then, if you've had this big move in defensive, and this has been a broad-based rally to date, where we've seen a large number of shares go from below their moving averages back above their MAs, going from 20% only above their MA to over 60% now, just in the last 3 months, then this has been a broad-based rally. But we're now starting to see that some of these leading shares are starting to roll over, and that's important. That's, generally speaking, companies lead for a reason, and they lead in both directions. Well, we know what the reason was, that because they have high growth and they have defensive characteristics, that they were attractive, particularly in an environment where there wasn't much going on. So the fact that they are beginning to roll over, that is certainly something, that is a warning signal that this very impressive 10-week uptrend has probably run out of steam to a certain extent. And then we look at the medium term, and the market has been going sideways for just about 18 months. The Dow Jones was in positive territory today and is closing back above the 18,000 level. But by and large, it's been range bound. And range bound after what was an incredibly impressive rally and breakout for the S&P 500 to new all-time highs. And that occurred in 2013. And when we look at trends and we look at the consistency of moves, what we look for is that the trend get progressively more consistent, because a big bull market will suck in adherence from all over the world, and that creates an incentive to hold on to supply rather than just let it go, and that takes it out of the market. So then you get an increasingly wide imbalance between supply and demand, and that creates the consistency of the trend. And that's exactly what we saw on the S&P 500, where we had a very choppy environment between about 2009 and 2011, and it was highly the role of quantitative easing was highly influential in supporting that bull market. But I think everyone started to get the message around 2012 that monetary policy was going to be accommodative for the foreseeable future, and then the consistency of the trend became progressively better. But then it started to change about a year ago, or a year and a half ago, and that was when the taper began, and some of the liquidity and it's not so much that liquidity was taken out of the market, but that less was added in. And the way to think about that in terms of the financial markets is that people generally take a good idea and then take it to extremes and add leverage onto it in order to juice it and get the absolute most possible benefit from a situation. And as long as the pace of the advance in liquidity was continuing to increase, then that was what was helping to drive the consistency of the market. But when it changed, then we moved into this much more range-bound environment. And then we have, this is ample evidence, that this was a liquidity-fueled rally in many respects. And that liquidity was moved into the bond markets. The liquidity helped to fuel massive issuance of corporate debt, which allowed corporations to improve their weighted average cost of capital. Then it also helped them to buy back a lot of their own shares. And the fact that the liquidity now has changed is a very important factor, because in a liquidity-fueled rally, then liquidity really does have a very large role to play, which is why we really should be looking at bond yields, and particularly short-dated bonds, because that gives us a great insight into how the bond market is anticipating exactly what the Fed is likely to do. The bond market is an awful lot larger than the equity market, and the role of interest rates on the bond market is so much more important than they really have to have a view. And what we're seeing is that there was a great deal of ambivalence and doubting of the Fed's prognostication that they were going to raise interest rates 4 times this year. They're still talking about 2 times, and the bond market is telling us they're going to do it once. But if yields rally from here, it would suggest then that that once might be happening sooner rather than later, which is likely to act as a headwind for the equity markets, and not least because they're pretty close to all-time highs. Now, the outperformance of the commodity sector, and there is still a great deal of, I think, debate about the sustainability of the move that we've had in commodities. And some of the big miners are saying that they don't anticipate the rally lasting. We have major central banks saying that they don't think the rally is going to last. But what we are presented with is an environment where the medium-term downtrend has broken. And it's going to go either one of two ways. But when you see a downtrend that has been broken in such dynamic fashion, then generally speaking, what that is a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Then you get a short covering rally, and there is no doubt there was shorts in the market. Then it goes faster and farther than the majority of people thought was even possible. But then it rolls over because people start, then the shorts have been covered. It relies on new demand coming in. People will see that prices are already up 100% or even 200% off their lows. So they don't want to chase the market, and they're reticent because they don't want to be caught out. And, you know, particularly with commodities, people will have learned that they're best bought on weakness. So we can anticipate a range, and that range could happen in the region of the moving average, or we could see it come all the way back down and test the lows. That would be the most bearish outcome, that it comes all the way right back down and tests the lows. Whereas the more bullish outcome is that it holds the majority of the advance, and then we move into a more rangy environment. And we might be on the cusp of something like that because the dollar may well rally from here. So those are short-term considerations. Medium-term, when we look at the rally in commodities, generally speaking, you do not get a big rally in commodities until you have a catalyst. And generally, in this stage of the cycle, that catalyst is somewhat better economic growth. And we do have better economic growth in the USA. And the big, the one that we don't know a great deal about, or there are some very polarized opinions about, is China. But China is ramping up production, particularly for steel. And they're still going through this really quite gradual and painful for some sectors rationalization of overcapacity, and that's something that's likely to last for a long time. But what we can also anticipate is that per capita consumption of commodities increases with rising standards of living, and standards of living in China are rising, and then we're not going to see an absolute decline in the per capita consumption of commodities, but rather that the per capita growth a demand cycle for those commodities is likely to moderate, and it has been moderating for a while, so let's say that it's going to continue to moderate. Well, then what the demand side of the equation has pulled back, demand growth has pulled back, to be more accurate, and then it's beginning to recover. Well, the European market is still plagued with politically motivated turmoil, but the economics of the Eurozone are probably not getting worse. So we'd have to consider that there is the potential for an upside surprise if anything starts to go right for Europe, rather than things getting progressively worse. Now, of course, we do have the Brexit vote coming up, and I don't think that much of the argument that we've seen in the UK, and obviously it's a UK-centred argument, so we're obviously seeing most of the commentary is about the ramifications for the UK, but I suspect that this is much more important for Europe than it is for the UK, because we just don't know what's going to happen when major treaties that required unanimous ratification in every single EU state are unraveled, or when somebody decides to leave, does it mean, and this is obviously a question for constitutional lawyers, but does it mean then that when one leaves, that everyone else is still bound to the treaty? Because surely the treaty would have to be rewritten. It's not as if they can just go back and cross out the UK's name from the treaty that everyone else signed. So these are very big questions, and I would love to see some constitutional views on exactly how things are likely to proceed, because it's a very large question and it looms large over the market until we get the result of the referendum. And right now it could really go either way. Well, that is certainly an issue for the Eurozone. And against that background, is there any real reason why the euro should be trading at 115 and at the upper side of its range? So I think what we're in for is some dollar strength in here. Now, with commodities rallying, where things are probably perhaps not as bad as had been priced in, and with commodity prices having stabilized, and particularly the industrial metals, then what we're seeing with commodities, and we don't yet have absolute copper-fastened confirmation that the commodity cycle has turned. When we look at a number of those commodity stock indices, they've unwound oversold conditions relative to their MAs. And what they really need to do is to rally above them to confirm that demand is back in the driver's seat. What we have seen is that the continuous commodity index has broken back above its trend mean. It has broken its progression of lower rally highs. And generally speaking, when you get these kinds of rallies in commodities, it tells you that you're pretty late in the cycle. And the reason for that is because commodities would have pulled back because of, generally, it's because economics have not been particularly favorable. And that necessitated lower interest rates. And then when interest rates start to rise, it's generally because economies are getting better and commodities are highly leveraged to improving global economics. So then they start to rally, and they can rally powerfully from very depressed levels. And they will have been through these painful rationalizations. And that's certainly the case in some of these industrial commodities, and particularly in the mining operations, where you're in a sweet spot where prices are beginning to improve but spending is not increasing. So then you get cash flow accretion, and that's really what shareholders start to get motivated about. And generally speaking, I don't like drawing conclusions or comparisons between 2007 and anything at all, because it tends to bring up the big question about whether this is another 2007-2008. So, but what we did see in 2007 was that the banking sector was deteriorating, which had been the lead sector, and the resources sector was taking off, and the resources sector wasn't overly influenced by what had been rising interest rates for the last few years. It's really more responding to the fact that global economies were doing better and you had a period of synchronized global economic expansion. So they were not a lead indicator for the future recession. And commodities are unlikely to be a lead indicator for any future recession. So that's not what we'd be looking for. What we're actually looking at in the commodities is that this could potentially be a powerful rally, but it would be a late in the cycle rally. So and that is where one really does have to avoid myopia, because it's very easy to get very caught up in a sector that is doing very well, where you're making money, and to ignore what's going on out there in the wider scenario. And it really does come down to what exactly is it that some of these central banks are going to do with all the debt that they own. We just don't know. And that is the great unknowable, because the Fed has got a large quantity of debt that has to be rolled over or unwound in the next few years. And It was practically nothing last year. It's about 150 billion this year. But it is over 200 billion next year, and it's over 300 billion the year after. And I think it's more like 275 billion next year. And you know, that's a significant quantity. And when we look at where yields are right now, and what are they likely to do? Because if they're going to maintain the size of their balance sheet, then the Treasury will have to issue new debt. But what will the coupon be on that debt? And will the Treasury end up having to pay more for it? Well, if in that scenario, then the Treasury would have to issue additional bonds to maintain the source of the liquidity for the Fed, or the size of the Fed's balance sheet, then but the federal government would end up paying a higher coupon. So then that's a big question, and it's a question that I think the Fed will be answering for us, but probably not this year. So that's when we're going to have a potential issue. Now, because it isn't just sovereign bonds that are maturing on that time frame. There's a large quantity of corporate debt is going to be maturing in the 2018, 90, and 20 time frame. And corporations have taken out a great deal of debt, and they may be in a position at that point to pay back some of it. But by and large, what companies do is refinance their debt. And a large number of those companies could be refinancing at less attractive levels. So if we have to look into our crystal ball and say, well, when could there potentially be a bigger problem than the sort of the 2018 to 2019 area looks to be a prime candidate. And that's the primary reason I don't like drawing conclusions or comparisons, excuse me, with 2007, because I don't think that that's where we are in the cycle just yet, because commodities have really only just started to take off. And by and large, what we've had, and you just have to look at 10-year charts and you get a really very good view of exactly what it is, that we've had major breakouts for Wall Street in the last 3 years, and this is really the first big consolidation following what was a really very impressive breakout. And following such incredibly impressive breakouts, then you generally speaking, over the last 100 years, you don't get them petering out immediately. In fact, it wasn't until 1982 that the S&P valuation bottomed, but it had broken out in 1980. So what had happened was that you had this very large breakout, and then it entered this long ranging consolidation and actually went right down and tested the upper side of the underlying range, and at the same time earnings did not collapse, but the valuation improved. And there's no guarantee that history will repeat itself, but it could certainly rhyme. And we have two examples over the last 100 years of when these major ranges were completed. And then, you know, there's some evidence that these kinds of things do happen, and it isn't just on stocks, but you have these kinds of patterns in a large number of asset classes. So then medium term, we have this large consolidation, but long term, there is a continued strong case that this is a new secular bull market, and it's predicated on continued economic development and continued technological innovation and the rise of the global middle class. And that's all predicated, of course, for the rise of the global middle class on improving governance. And governance is improving, and particularly in the major population centers, and those are where the major economies are going to be in 50 years time. And the individual productivity of everyone is going to improve, not least because not only is technology, technological innovation accelerating, but that the availability of that technology is going increasingly global. And with the cost of that technology coming down, the market is increasing at an exponential rate. So that those are two very powerful characteristics that can fuel a secular bull market. And the low price of energy is a wonderful enabler. You know, I've seen many statistics saying that that when oil prices rally by $10, that it shaves 0.1 of a percent from a GDP growth. And oil prices went from $10 to $140. So that's 1.3% lower growth over the previous decade. And now we've got oil prices, which in fact were in positive territory today. So WTI is around $44 a barrel. So that is a wonderful economic enabler. And it probably hasn't filtered through because of the damage that had been done to the energy sector. But with prices, and the energy sector, in fact, has been doing better even than the resources sector in the US this year, and not least because there are more companies, but also because they're not spending either. And they've already invested a great deal of money, and they're not going to be investing more money until they get back to sustainable price levels. So with the fall off in investment, then they're also in a cash flow positive environment. So and that helps to really give us an indication that, you know, when you get sectors that have pulled back very sharply and they are leveraged to a sort of a more benign story, then you can get very impressive rallies. And we're certainly getting strong rallies in the resources sector. Now, when we look at the gold price, then gold has broken its medium-term downtrend, and it was weak today. It was down about $14, but it still remains within its range, and it would really need to break below $1,200 before I think anyone is going to get overly worried about it, because what it continues to look like is a first step above a type 2 base. And this range is characteristically volatile, and it could continue to be volatile. And certainly the gold shares have priced in an awful lot of good news in the very short term. But when you look at it over the medium term and the long term, then this is a cheap asset class. And when we start to think about what exactly is it that central banks are going to do, well, the Fed is slowly but surely starting to normalize its monetary policy. But the ECB, the Bank of Japan, and the Bank of China are a long way from normalization. In fact, they're much more likely to experiment. And I think when you use the term experiment, it means very clear that you don't actually know what the outcome is likely to be. And they really are hoping for the best, but they are employing some pretty extraordinary and brand new policies right now. And of course, I guess the lesson is that having embarked on that policy, they have no choice now but to follow it to its logical conclusion, because of the political capital invested in adopting these types of policies, then they just have to continue and to try and make them work. And if that's the case, then the supply of currency is going to increase. The relative attraction of fiat currencies that can simply be printed into existence or loaned into existence or borrowed into existence, relative to the to assets that cannot be printed into existence, which are hard assets like gold or like property, well then, there's an obvious attraction, and particularly for people that want to have some sort of insurance against the kind of environment that where central banks are experimenting with our life savings. And generally that's a bullish argument all on its own for why people are beginning to look at gold once more. Well, when we think about it in those terms, then a lot of people will be looking at gold as a barometer for risk, and then, you know, it is likely to be volatile. And something that has been practically a mantra between David and I for the last decade is that you just don't pay up for commodities. And we're likely to get, in the short term, a better opportunity to buy commodities because the dollar is beginning to find support, and there remains this, not a perfect inverse correlation, but certainly an inverse correlation in one way, shape, or form. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.